Good evening, Steele.
Good evening, Dave. It's been a little too long, but I'm glad to see you again.
It's an intense life I lead. Five children. It's a lot more than three.
Yeah, you look a little bit amphetamine powered tonight. I don't know if that's.
I drank a Coca-Cola today, so that's as far out as I go.
It's Mormon, Steel, Mormon meth.
We've had a lot of people emailing, writing the show. My mom's talked to me about this on numerous occasions. You keep talking about your best friend from childhood, Jack Bangeter, and. Everyone, all the feedback I keep getting is like, this guy's not real, right, Dave? And every week someone's asking me, like, Jack Bangeters is just like a made-up guy?
Well, I'm pleased to announce to our listeners, Jack Bangeter is, in fact, a real human being. And I'm as happy as I've ever been, Dave, because Jack has agreed to join us on the podcast tonight. Jack, buddy, it's been a long time. So glad to have you tonight.
Hey, thanks, guys. I'm happy to be here. It's a pleasure and an honor.
So as you're probably both aware, it's summertime right now. So it's a very popular season of the year for vacations. So I just want to start it off with talking a little bit about summer. You guys have any big summer vacation plans or something like that this year? You guys are so in tune.
I know. We planned that, Dave. We were going to say at the same time. Go ahead, Jack.
I don't have any existing summer plans. I do love the summer, but I've kind of done a bit of traveling already this summer and might go visit my nephew and niece in Oakland. So,
oh, yeah. Scenic Oakland. People love Oakland in the summer. Just beautiful.
Same with me, Dave. I've already done our traveling. It's just work from here on out for me.
We were on vacation last week, Steele.
Where'd you go?
And I'm still completely shattered. I can't. Like, it was just too intense. I never want to go on vacation again. We traveled 45 minutes away and stayed in a cabin 45 minutes away. And it's too much for me.
Yeah, why sleep somewhere that's not your home, where everything you know is familiar and already baby-proof? It seems like such a bad idea. We hardly do it with one kid. I can't imagine five.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So my girls are recovering, but they're just constantly screaming at me at all opportunities. My girls are awesome, but vacation, it throws them off.
I would say this has been a good summer in my life, decent one, but not the greatest summer of my life. I don't know what your experience has been, but where would you rank this in terms of your all-time summers, Dave? The summer of five.
It has to be up there. An introduction of additional children, it's great, but still, I think you know my greatest summer. I've talked to you about it so many times. Yeah. 1987.
I was just gonna say 1987. That was your greatest summer.
I don't know how many conversations we've had about this.
Oh, the old summer of 87.
7 years old, living outside Houston, Texas, neighborhood swimming pool. We, in our blue custom van, pulling a pop-up trailer, we took the greatest vacation of all time. Studies have been shown that this is the greatest one that's ever been done.
Well, so are you going to tell us more about it or just that it was the best?
Just the best.
Okay,
cool. Still, we made it, Texas over to California. We hit up, like, Disneyland was the destination, but it was much more about the journey. Carlsbad Caverns, Painted Desert, Petrified Forest, Grand Canyon, Disneyland, Knott's Berry Farms, back through Utah. We're talking Bryce, Zions. And at some point, we left my oldest brother in a visitor center. It was awesome.
That sounds fantastic. That's a lot of ground you covered. Was your van by chance a 1986 Chevy G20 Sport?
I think it was. Do you have a familiarity with this kind of van?
Yeah, I live in one.
How is your van equipped, Jack?
It's got a bed in the back, and that folds down. Puppy and I sleep back there. I've got a dog that stays with me all the time. She's kind of like my five children. Well, the van actually doesn't move anywhere, so it's just parked behind my art studio here. And I just go there to sleep.
Is it a working van? Could you start it up and, you know, go to Circle K if you were inclined?
I could, if I charged the battery, I could start it up, but the transmission's shot, so it won't go anywhere.
So it's like a non-mobile apartment.
It's kind of like a bed in a box in the parking lot.
With a radio? Hello? Come on. Don't leave out the most important part.
I have to use the internet out there to get radio because the battery's dead.
It's dead. Well, so, okay. Yeah. So it is a bed
just,
in a box.
It's just a bed. I basically just use it as a bed.
Sounds like you got this summer thing figured out, though, Jack.
He heard, I must have, we talked about 87 before he got inspired. He just enjoyed the van so much. Do you get any, do you guys have any summers you think can, like, I guess have a showdown with mine, or do you have any thoughts on a great summer in your life?
So I've had a couple of really good summers lately, but I think the best summer had to have been before I was like fully an adult and had to worry about stuff. And I think that serving an LDS mission really marked a turning point in my life. Before it, almost all the summers were really fun. And after it, none of them have been that fun. There's a lot of reasons for that. But I think that probably the best summer of my life was either the one right before my mission or the one right before I went to college for the first time. I was young. I was in good shape. I was outside a lot, tanned a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Just my body was glistening, muscular.
That's really important to a good summer.
It really is. At the swimming pool a ton. I was working with kids at an after-school center and like an all-day play thing, so it was just really fun. And I was reading a bunch, listening to tons of records. I went thrift store shopping a lot, often with Jack. And I was making out a lot with my then-girlfriend. So it was like really all the boxes were getting checked.
Yeah, the ideal Mormon summer. It sounds great.
It really was.
How about you, Jack?
I think, I don't know, for best things, I always pick things with traveling in them. So like best summers, like something with some good traveling also. I think in 2003, I'd just come back from living in the Netherlands on a study abroad. And I had a whole new perspective on like what life was about at that point. And then I was home for like a week or two, and my dad called me. He'd gone to Brazil with his brother. They weren't having the greatest time down there together, so he invited me to come down and hang out with him. Then it was like double traveling the world summer, just seeing like really crazy stuff that I wasn't really prepared for at the time. You know, I was like 22 years old or something, and just kind of like shot into a new world I wasn't expecting. But that's a... Those are my favorite things, when I get into something unexpected and learn something new.
Was that your first time living outside the country, Jack? Or even, I mean, you'd traveled outside the country, right?
I'd gone on a trip to Europe with my brother, and we did like driving around to little campgrounds in Europe in 2000. That was a pretty fun summer too. Yeah, I first lived abroad in 2003 in Groningen, the Netherlands. Studying art history.
I was living abroad in 2003 and my summer sucked.
You probably weren't as free to do your thing.
No, I was wearing a shirt, tie, jacket, and knocking on doors in council estates in the north of England. It was hot.
Yeah.
Council estate summers, they're great, man. There's something magical up there. Yeah, something really magical.
Do you know council estates, Dave?
Oh, I've spent many, many hours knocking on doors there. I served a mission in England as well, just south of Steele. One time I accidentally went into his mission, and it was a breath of fresh air. Beautiful mission up there. But guys, so we, of course, because this is Steele's friend, we're not going to talk about humorous subjects tonight. We're going to talk about some important things. Ideally, we'll be able to get a little bit of talk about death in here somewhere, but we'll see. But we're going to talk about some social change, off the chain, social change. And we've got a new segment called Art Talk with Jack Bangeter, which we're hoping that we can spin it off into a publicly funded television show. And then, of course, we're going to finish off with Unchained Melodies and Book Wisdom. But still, off the chain, social change. What are we talking about? What's going on in this segment?
So, Dave, our society is vexed. Social problems on every side. There's structural racism. The country's up in arms over police shootings. A bunch of really, really sad stories. But what I want to talk about, actually, is something that I just learned about recently, Laurel and I have thought about, that strikes us as both really cool, really interesting, and in some ways really strange, because most of the time when I think about social change and altruism, I think about things that are driven by our deep feelings, by our heart. And there's a group of people out there that are trying to take the heart out of charitable giving and like make it maximally rational. And it's nice. Both amazing and kind of backwards. So there's a movement called effective altruism, and it's the leading proponent is like a philosopher that teaches at Oxford, and it's a group of people that are looking to quantify the actual effect of charitable giving. They want to maximize the happiness years or the increase in human happiness, decrease in suffering, increased lifespan for every dollar you might give, and say you should give to the things that have the greatest possible impact and the lowest possible cost. And so they're basically ranking charitable giving and say this is where you should give if you want to do the most good with your money.
Where's our number one spot, do you know?
Yeah, it's fighting malaria. There's a specific foundation that they recommend. If you want to see some more specific recommendations, there's a website called Give Well. It's givewell.org. They review charities and they give their recommendations for the top charities. Then right now, the number one is the Against Malaria Foundation and the Deworm the World Initiative. And then there's a couple of others. It's pretty cool. They're trying to provide like empirical tools into how your giving can do the most good in the world, independent of where you live, independent of who you know. But like, where is this dollar going to do the most good for the world or people in the world? And there's some really hardcore nerds that want to quantify altruism. And it's kind of fascinating to us.
Well, I'm a huge fan of deworming, so that's great.
Yeah, deworming's good. One of those on the list that you just bypassed, I think, is actually a very interesting type of charity, though. I think it's number four on their list.
Yeah, the direct giving.
Which is called Give Directly.
Yeah.
Which I'm just going to give a little spot to Amazon Smile here. I don't know if you guys are familiar with this, but Amazon Smile is like a free way to use Amazon through their website, and a portion of the money you spend goes to the charity of your choice. And it's a really easy way, if you use Amazon, to be giving a little bit of money back to people. It doesn't cost you anything. It just costs Amazon a little bit of money, and probably doesn't cost them either, because they probably write it off in taxes. But anyway, you get to decide where it goes. So
cool. Yeah. I've never heard of that, Jack. So I'm gonna do it. Give Directly.
Yeah. Yeah, you can put Give Directly in there. I changed mine to a homeless action center in Oakland that helped my father out for a little while when he first moved there. So
the heart, man. The heart speaks louder than rational choice sometimes, you know?
It sometimes does.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of rational choices in this. I find that it's problematic giving money to charities anyway.
Well, that's a pretty good segue into what I've got to talk about here. Charity water. Are either of you guys familiar with that at all?
No. When you sent me an email that just said the word charity water in it, I thought it was some kind of joke or that you were going to make fun of something. But it sounds legit, Dave. Tell us more.
So the founder, what is this guy's name? It's Scott Harrison. This guy just seemed like an all-time kind of douche. He was a club promoter in New York City. And like his whole life was getting people to go to really expensive clubs and spend thousands of dollars on alcohol. That's like, he was just planning parties all the time. This was all he did. And shockingly, he didn't find fulfillment in that. I don't understand, but he didn't find fulfillment doing that. And eventually he went on, you know, with like a charity to Africa. And what he was seeing over there, that there was tons of issues because people just lacked clean water. So he started this charity called Charity Water. He used his former like club promotion skills to promote giving to drill wells. So the kind of cool thing about it is he gets people to donate to fund the organization. So if you give to Charity Water, the money's going directly to drilling wells in Africa and going directly to getting people clean water. It's just exciting that this guy, I guess, turned away. Unfortunately, he's not in the top four on what you just showed us still, but I still think it's pretty effective giving, and it's neat to just to be able to see one thing that they really believe in is showing direct results of your giving, and they can track where your money went. And if you donate $10,000, they will use that money to drill a well and show you, like, this is the well in this city in Africa that happened because of you.
I was really impressed on their website. Like, they were very open and seemingly transparent about all their financial information. They made that information public and clear, and I think that's absolutely the way to do both government and charitable organizations. That's awesome.
Except for your tax returns, you can't reveal those regardless of how public a figure you are. You just can't reveal those.
Unless everybody else does.
No, oh, yeah. even then, don't do it.
It's a trick. It's a trick. Yeah. All right, Jack, what do you want to talk about for some social change stuff that matters to you?
Well, I think the charity thing is like one way that people can participate in making social change. Mm-hmm. But I think there are like lots of other ways to get out there and do something. And you don't necessarily have to be really active. You don't have to go build somebody a house. I mean, it's a great thing to do to be like participating in your community. But for example, one of the things that I've been participating in is called Vote Allies. And a friend of mine here in LA put this together. And it's a program where people share their votes. And what that means is that there are people that are eligible to vote, and there are people that are ineligible to vote. And those are often like prisoners, mm-hmm. Both in prison and people that have been released from prison,
but
who in different states have different rights. So in some states you can vote even when you're in prison and have committed a felony. And in other states you can't even like for a lifetime after you've committed a felony. And then there's all the states in between. But this also includes undocumented immigrants and people under the age of 18, all of whom have legitimate voices in their communities. And this program allows you to share your vote with them by talking to them about the issues that are interesting and agreeing that if you guys agree, you can go and vote with their points of view in mind. So it's not actually, no votes are actually being given away, but the idea is that you're communicating with people about the political process and about things that matter to everybody.
I think the part that's especially cool is like it's particularly looking to partner with people who can vote but don't use the privilege regularly or often, and people who really want to vote and would love to but aren't eligible for whatever reason. And that's like a cool amplification of democracy idea in a way that doesn't feel like vote or fraud or dishonest to me, but feels like, yeah, this is faithful to the spirit of community building, of democracy, and of like civic engagement in a way that I really like, Jack.
Yeah, there. Not everybody feels the same way as you do about it, Steele, but I agree with that. I think opening up, just like you were saying about having things transparent for financial reasons or whatever, this is kind of a transparent voting idea. It's like, open this baby up. Let's get everybody involved.
And from what I understand, there's been over 112 marriages based on people meeting through this vote partnership. It's not only a beautiful political active campaign, but just romance too. Romance blooms once you start talking politics.
Oh yeah. They say, what are the things they say to really talk about on your first date? Politics, and religion.
Well, and
religion's
death.
One of them.
Yeah. Death.
Yeah. Yeah. At least twice about death. Yeah.
How many kids you want? Is that
Yeah.
Me and my wife, five, we're a five first date. So.
Did you guys say five on your first date?
Of course. And we talked about death and yeah. And it seems like this would really, these kind of voters are mobilizing for Trump, I'd assume. So that's neat too.
Dave's just happy about anything that can bring out the Trump vote.
Oh yeah.
But guys, I did you have any more social issues you wanted to discuss tonight, guys?
I think it's really important to get people to start thinking about social change and the things that they want for their own life and their own world at a young age. And I think that I knew about it for a while, but there's a cool program called Radical Monarchs, which is basically like a pseudo Girl Scouts for people who want their kids to radicalize their own future. And I think they kind of mean it in a radical, like surf style way, but they take on some pretty serious issues. So,
yeah, I think that's the thing that gives me hope about like young people. They may not know that much, but so many of them are active in like stuff that matters, you know? I'm going to cut that out too. That didn't sound great at all. But I don't know. The energy of young people and the enthusiasm.
Young people, they're not allowing their complete ignorance to stop them from making real social change. Yeah, they're driving these issues that they don't understand, and I really appreciate that.
They make loud public noises, you know? And without them, it would sure be a lot quieter in public spaces.
Yeah, how about this Pokemon Go thing?
Yeah, that was like what all the dads were talking about at the playground tonight. We'll have to say that for another podcast.
We've been trying to introduce some of these ideas to my daughters a little bit, and that's been neat. One of the cool things about Charity Water is there's a few different stories they share of, and they kind of show like kids will give away their birthday. Like they get really interested in getting people clean water, and they'll just say like, for my birthday this year, I just want people to give to Charity Water. And so we've tried to introduce our girls some of those ideas so they can just see that they can make a difference for people in by their own actions. That's rather awesome. Than just being like, oh, this stinks that their life is so hard. But guys, let's do this art talk with Jack Bangeter.
We need like a do 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 do. Welcome to Art Talk with Jack Bangeter. Anyway,
I think that's perfect intro.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I think that's all we need. You did it. So, Jack, we've got a few just kind of hard-hitting quick questions, and we've got a few that we want you to think a little bit more about. But let's just start by getting to know a little bit about your art and what you like to do. So what's your favorite medium that you use?
Well, I love watercolor, and it's what I do the most of also. So it's a good combo. I find it very freeing. It is a medium that kind of hard to control. So it does its own thing, which is sort of what I look for in art is, while I'm creating it, I want to sort of have an adventure while creating. So it works well for that.
So Jack, if someone were to ask you like, I don't know, like, what do you do? Do you, what's the noun that you use or the set of nouns? Do you say I'm an artist, I'm a painter, I'm a watercolorist? What's the descriptor that you would use?
I tell people that I'm an artist, but then I say that I'm mostly a painter and that I work in watercolor and oil. And then if people care to know more, I do a lot of other stuff like World Cup hair or make a video or do a sculpture or whatever, you know.
Do you feel like there's a medium that's calling to you right now or a medium that you feel like interested in trying or exploring more in your art practice?
Well, speaking of sculptures, I just picked up a bunch of clay recently, which is something that I haven't done for a while. And I'm going to attempt to build some kind of crazy fountain.
Like a functional
piece? We'll see how it works.
Or decorative or a bit of both?
Well, how functional is a fountain?
Depends if there's water in it or if people just look at it.
Yeah, it's not to drink from. It'll just be to look at, but it will be functioning.
Could it be like half urinal, half fountain? Because that would be functional as well.
Actually, it's the idea of it is very close to that. At least maybe it's not actually a urinal, but some people might think that the ideas in it are sort of for the toilet.
That's art we can all get behind, Jack.
Yeah. So do you find that when do you find living in a van, does that give credibility to your art when you tell people about this, or does that take away cred?
It probably does both for different people. I didn't really mean to end up in the van, but when I tell people that are artists and stuff, they kind of go, oh yeah, cool, you're like doing it right, you know? And it's like, I don't know if I really am or not.
Doesn't feel like that to me exactly, but thanks.
Yeah, so, it's good and bad, I guess, at the same time. It has its pluses and minuses.
So what inspired you to be an artist? How long has this been part of something that you want to do and been pursuing?
Well, I got my first oil painting kit from my dad. My dad was an artist. And so he gave me a painting kit when I was, I think, 10 years old, like a French easel, which is like one of those that you take out into nature and set up and have all your paints in the same box. And he gave me a book, or he took me to the bookstore and we bought an art book, which was called The Fauve Landscape, which is actually a pretty cool book. But it's the fauvists who paint in bright colors and bold lines and stuff like this. So I kind of, I don't know, worked around with art, but I didn't really know what being an artist was. Maybe until that summer that I went with my brother to Europe, we checked out some museums, and I kind of got a different perspective of what the worldwide view of an artist was, rather than what people in Boise thought artists were, which is a very different thing. Not that one's better than the other, they're just very different things. And I liked the one that I saw from Exploring the World. I think I wanted to be that.
So when you're, I guess, yeah, in Europe, you've done some traveling. Were there things that inspired you there, that particularly, I guess, movements or schools that you've come to identify with?
Yeah. Well, like I mentioned, the Fauvists is one that I came to identify with from very early.
For people who are listening that may not be familiar with this term, how's that word spelled? Is that F-A-U-V?
V-E.
Okay.
F-A-U-V-E. And I think it means, or is roughly translated to, like, the wild beasts or something like that is kind of what they call these guys. They were taking Impressionism to the next level, really, and just saying, like, we don't even care to, like, make an impression of the color that's exactly there. We're just going to say, if that looks kind of yellow, I'm going to paint it yellow, which is a pretty bold move at the time. But now we kind of recognize it as looking pretty normal, like, famous painter style or something. I don't know. But I also studied De Stijl, which is a Dutch movement when I was in the Netherlands. And that's like Mondrian. A lot of people are familiar with him, which is like very...
blocks of square color.
Yeah, black lines, square colors, right angles. There are a few different thoughts, depending on who you're talking to in the group there. But I think the interesting thing with the things that have inspired me is art isn't necessarily that I incorporate them. Like, I don't do artwork like Mondrian, but I like the attitude with which he approaches asking questions about what art is.
I've always known you as an artist, and I think we've both looked at some art together or talked about artists or like looked at artists' websites, and like so often I'll look at artwork and I think, oh, that's interesting, I enjoy the artwork. And then I hear or I see the artist write about it, or they're talking about their work, and I'm just like, oh man, you should have just kept silent and let me experience the artwork. You like ruined it but with your artist statement. Why is it that so many artist statements make me want to like punch them in the face, Jack? Not all artists, I know, is the hashtag or whatever for this, but like, what do you experience this too, and what the hell?
Well, as an artist, I've experienced writing a bad artist statement, as well as experienced times when I should have just shut my mouth instead.
Yeah,
those are definitely things that happen. But I think this happens, and you are a good example of why it shouldn't happen, because you're well-versed in writing and language, and artists aren't necessarily writers. And many of them complain about that they have to write to kind of convince people that what they're writing is, or what they're doing is legitimate. That puts a lot of pressure on artists whose job isn't to write to impress people. So they go out of their way to write something that doesn't really actually express the thoughts that they are having about their art, and more become something that they try to sound really smart with, like they've really thought about this a long time. And they probably have, but changing the way to write about it is a good idea.
So I recently, I was on a backpack trip pretty recently, and for some reason we had like a 4-hour conversation about self-promotion of art, or just self-promotion of something you're doing and you're pushing it out there. And just so much of it is really douchey. How do you approach it and not be a douche, I guess? I don't know.
And I know you have complex feelings about
capitalism.
Some people
think I'm a douche.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I use some websites like Saatchi Art to sell some work of mine and prints and things. I don't really go out of my way to promote it, but artists have to make livings, you know? We got to figure out a way to sell some of it. So, and galleries aren't exactly the easiest thing to get working with. Even if you have a gallery, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to support you through many years of work. So you've got to kind of promote yourself somehow. As far as being douchey, I think you can just be like overly pushy or something about some artwork, and it's a tough line, you know?
Yeah. I think there's the problem with like presenting artistic vision and being a salesperson, and there's a weird confluence of those things. The thing I was going to ask you about in relation to this though, Jack, is that I feel like watching you develop as a person and as an artist, there are definitely things that you have chosen, that you've drawn a hard line in and said, this is my identity. This is core to who I am. This is self-expression. And there are things that have gone well in your life because of it. And I think that the things that you've sacrificed that have felt like have fallen out of your life or have not worked in your life because of your commitment to your art. And I don't think that's really well understood by maybe the rest of us who are like working a 9-to-5 and like doing the thing that we have to do that we may not love in the same way, or that isn't self-expressive in the same way or idea expressive. What do you feel like has been like both the benefits of a life devoted to art and things that looking on the outside, people might not understand about what it is to live as an artist?
Well, I'm not sure all artists live like this, but I've found that it doesn't matter if I decide to do something else. I still want to be making art. And that's like, and if I'm wealthy, I'm going to be making art. And if I'm poor, I'm going to be making art. And basically, I'm not really happy doing anything else. And the time I dedicate to that becomes more important than, I don't know, my own living situation, for instance, or healthy food or whatever. Some of those things I can kind of give up. Having things, I don't know, they aren't... Sure, I've got some things around, but the value of those is less to me than the ability to work when I want to on the thing that is popping into my mind at the moment, maybe.
Does making art feel like a compulsion for you? That's a little bit how I'm hearing you describe it. Like, unless I like satisfy this compulsion, I feel unfulfilled or unhappy?
Yeah, I'm not sure it makes me happy to even do it. But yeah, maybe so it is a compulsion that I'm just going to do anyway.
It's a disorder. It sounds like a disorder.
Yeah, it probably is. I think that's why most people don't understand it, is because I'm just a sicko.
Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of in relation to this, like, yeah, I have a very practical career. You know, I'm a nurse practitioner. Someone has a sore throat, they come see me. But I also really enjoy painting and stuff. I enjoy watercolors. I like them because I can make it look good even if I'm not very good at doing it. It can still look really interesting. But so what do you see the value of what art is adding to society, what you're doing for, I guess, the community as a whole?
That's a really good question. A lot of my work, well, when I paint in watercolor, I'll just take a small example. I often think about what's happening around me immediately and try and put that into a scene or something. Or if I'm outside painting plein air style, I try to capture the entire environment. And often that incorporates not nice things. And so you start to develop a body of work with some things that aren't exactly very nice. And I think that those can open people's minds to things like social change. If they see other people recognizing some types of problems or some types of ideas that they recognize also, it allows people to kind of free up and try to work on those issues. And it works for things that aren't that other artists do that aren't necessarily about social change or something, but about how we think about an image or how we think about many issues.
You look at artists and musicians and a lot of work that they've done has fueled social change. What do you guys think? What is it about the mindset of someone that's engaged in creative pursuits that, and I guess, enables them and encourages them to embrace social change and doing good for others?
Well, I think this is a complex question, Dave, for me at least, and then I'll let Jack speak to it. But like, because I think I'm a little bit of a cynic about art's political efficaciousness or utility. Like, I think art itself very rarely changes things. Like, there's a famous a line from a poem that says, "Poetry makes nothing happen." And I think in some ways,
that's poetry, though. Still,
yeah, okay. Well, so that's the meat. I chose the least effective. But what I do think is that, like, good or powerful art, what it can do is it can either absorb, require, or focus attention in human subjects that are viewing it. And sometimes it's a group, sometimes it's an individual, but it's the act of requiring or changing the focus of attention. And then with that altered or focused attention, those people then can proceed to do something political or do something social or do something efficacious. And so I think of art as like a lens of focus that says, like, here, see this thing, feel this thing, know this thing. And it's like a placing or removing of like perceptual lenses that then can lead to social change. And for me, that's how I see it. And maybe that's wrong, but that's my feeling on it.
I don't think that's wrong. I feel very strongly the same way, that it's a place for people to look at their own minds or their own thoughts. And it's very interesting also because the viewer is actually the ultimate point where the painting really gets meaning.
Yeah,
is when somebody not the artist sees it and interprets it. And what they do with that interpretation can be very powerful. But the painting itself or the poem itself didn't necessarily do that. And maybe it wasn't even intended to.
Right. Like, there's all kinds of unintentional effects of art, right? You know, like,
yeah.
And that's cool. They're both over and under determined objects in terms of their meaning, I think.
And as far as getting some kind of greater value for society from these types of things, I just think that the world really runs on creativity. And without people thinking like way outside the box or trying to push boundaries down, it makes it even harder for businesses or something to then also kind of break boundaries. I think the arts, I like to think the arts anyway, are the cutting edge of how to think or something.
Yeah, like human possibility in some ways.
Yeah, human possibility in thought or something. And then how you use that changes.
And you were talking about like that art acquires its meaning in the interaction with the perceiver or the viewer. And I want to ask you about your own formation as a viewer. Like, you have a personal aesthetic taste that both informs the art you make, but also the art that you like and the art that you're drawn to. What do you like or dislike in art, and how did you develop that preference? Because I feel like that's something that grows and changes over time, and you have a unique path to it.
I like artwork that makes me think, and often that is artwork that is different than the artwork that I do. Which isn't necessarily the way that many other artists work.
Sure.
I think a lot of people, like, if you're a painter and you kind of paint like Van Gogh, you might really like Van Gogh.
Yeah.
For instance, a simple example, but I'm really impressed by artists that think differently than I do and people that think differently than I do. Of course, I probably people know that I like to try and make people think the way that I do. But I really appreciate other opinions. It's what gets my mind rolling, different types of possibilities.
So another thought or question I have for you is in the creative community, there's always, at least in America, there's a criticism attached to any of these things. That it's a whole industry. You have art critics, you have music critics, and this is some, you know, it helps direct people find whatever they want. Does criticism affect what you do on a day-to-day basis? And do you search for, I guess, collaborators or people to help bounce ideas off of, that sort of thing?
I like to work with other people a lot because of the questions that you ask each other about the project that you're doing. So you really do get to critical questions about your idea. At the same time, well, as far as like art critics goes, I really don't know that world. It's something that goes on in a bit of a higher echelon of art than I am really part of.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know. It's also part of something that, yeah, has a lot of attachments to giving people jobs and providing a regular economy. So there is a strange relationship between art and money and criticism and galleries and museums and all these kinds of things that many artists complain a lot about. I tend to complain about it sometimes as well. Of course, there's both sides of the story, and I don't have a gallery now, for instance, that's representing me, but I don't really necessarily like galleries, but I'm sure that there's a gallery that I would like, and I'm sure that I would find the benefit that they would provide to me as well.
Yeah.
So I don't know how to really.
I mean, for me, you know, it helps a lot of times to have some type of a gateway. You know, music critics help me discover stuff, and art critics, I think, help me sometimes understand things. But it's interesting. I don't know if either of you guys ever listened to All Songs Considered by NPR, but I love Bob Boylan. I think he's awesome. And he makes music. I have no interest in ever hearing any music that he makes, but I love to hear what he says about other people's music.
Yeah, and that's the, I think, the thing about colleagues or as artists also, is that they provide that, I think, more than critics do or something. That's a bit of, in general, an outside of the art creation process.
Yeah, I think that's
they
true. They
also tend to go to galleries or to museums to criticize the work rather than at the source with the artist, which is something that I would encourage all people to do, is rather than to expect the galleries and the museums to give you acceptable art, to find the acceptable art yourself and then go and talk to the artists. Artists are really friendly, and they make more money if you buy artwork from them out of their gallery than they do from the gallery or from the museum or whatever like that. So if you get a chance, talk to an artist, and you don't have to buy stuff from them. They're friendly.
The van door is always open.
Show you stuff.
And I'll say, in addition to the van door, we've been talking with Jack for a while, but Jack, you have a website that features pictures of some of your art. It's jackbangeter.net. We'll put a link on our thing. And, I do think it would make a difference if you want to decorate your home and you're looking for original art to buy for it. I bet you could work something out with Jack if you wanted to really scare off your visitors, you know?
Yeah, it's not all scary. I've got plenty of nice stuff too. But yeah, anybody can email me. There's not always like prices or push a button and buy it. So yeah, but
we
yeah.
We have two Jack Bangeter originals in our collection, our private collection. So, Jack, we were talking a bunch of like lighthearted, trivial topics, but we want to get to what really matters most, I think, Dave. We got some quick hit questions?
Yes, I'm excited for them. So Jack, I think me and Steele are just both going to throw some out. And yeah, I think anybody can chime in on this. This is Art Talk with Jack Bangeter, of course. Favorite chocolate bar?
Milky Way has always been a favorite of mine.
Oh, bad choice. Steele? Oh.
I like Butterfinger and Heath bars in terms of the commercial ones, but lately I've been going to Trader Joe's and buying the Pound Plus dark chocolate. Every time I go, I get two of those Pound Plus bars, and they usually last me a couple weeks.
Beautiful.
How about you, Dave?
Favorite chocolate bar? I really like Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Does that count as a chocolate bar?
It's not a chocolate bar, but that's a good candy. All right, next question. Favorite comic book artist?
I have to say that I really don't know comic book art that well, but I thought maybe some children's book illustrators might be somewhat similar.
Totally, sure. Throw it out.
I thought William Stieg, or Steig, I'm not sure the pronunciation, but he's also like a New Yorker cartoonist.
Dave's got five kids, so he's like writing these names down furiously.
Yeah. And then there's Ezra Jack Keats, which was always a favorite of mine. Whistle for Willie. I don't know if you guys remember that one.
We have the Snowy Day by Ezra Jack Keats.
Snowy Day is great. Yeah. 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 That's and I like the illustrations from that. I don't know if I would, what I'd say about the stories, but I'm just saying illustrations. So that's the art, right?
Yeah. Dave?
If we're going children's books, I've been way into, I don't even know how to say this guy's name, John Agee.
We have the rhinoceros book of his.
He's so good. We have right now. We have It's Only Stanley from the library. It's what we have to buy it. I love it. It's so good. And his art is very just very simple and but just very clear. I really like the style he has.
Favorite female artist?
That's one that I. One of my first experiences in a museum on that same trip with my brother in Europe, I saw a small film, a little documentary by an artist, Tacita Dean. And that was kind of when I realized that what art was, like I was talking to you about, like there's a bigger world of art. When I saw that particular, I remember seeing that particular video, it really inspired me. She was trying to find a Robert Smithson Landwerk sculpture. And the video was just the journey. So just changed my mind about what art was.
Cool.
This one was called The Partially Buried Woodshed. And I think it's actually, it was on the University of Wisconsin campus, maybe.
What? We got to talk off air about this because this is quick. Okay.
Yeah, get out there. All right. I've got some, both you guys, fireworks. Yes or no?
Yes.
I have to say no right now because my dog doesn't like them. But otherwise, I like them.
My son doesn't like them either. As an idea, not in the hand. Bad idea. Don't hold them.
Unless it's a sparkler, then that's okay. Favorite decade in which you've lived?
90s?
Yeah, 90s.
Oh, boy.
How about you?
Great. Right now, I'm all in.
What are these called? The teens?
The teens. I don't know what to call them. That's why I said right now. I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
Sunset or sunrise?
Sunset.
Sunrise. Let's get that day going.
Yeah. Sunrise. You're running into the sun. Beautiful.
Sunset.
I'm sorry, Steele. Best dance move.
Oh, man. You're asking Jack Bangeter for his best dance move? This guy's a legend.
Is it my own personal best dance
move?
Yes.
Yes, your best dance move.
I'd have to say it's the giraffe, yes. Which is like the total life cycle of a giraffe all in one dance. That's my best one, I think.
I thought he was going to say the lucky answer. Necromancer.
That was my second favorite. So one or the other of those.
Mountains or beach?
I think mountains because I live near the beach now.
I don't care as long as it's West Coast, man.
Word.
I'll take either one.
That's right.
But we got to be Midwest. West. Rockies or West. Otherwise, neither.
Midwest is the worst. So... What is a Pokemon?
Like actually?
I don't know the answer either, Dave. But I do know that when we were in high school, Pokemon cards were a big craze, and so Jack made his own version, one of these original art projects, and I still have a set of these playing cards, and they were called Jackamon? Were they called?
Jackarin.
Jackarin?
Yeah.
And they were all of us were drawn as characters on them, and Steele is a character, and I'm having carnal relations with Jack's dog. I don't know if I can find a picture of that, but I'll try to put it up on our blog.
I think I've probably got one around I can take a photo of.
I'm glad you held on to that.
I think I've got the original artwork from it.
I'd like it framed. Send me a price. I'll bid on it.
All right.
Okay, here's an important question. Medical marijuana, how much has it improved your art?
Not any more than the non-medical kind did.
Marijuana, how much has it improved your life?
Not really very much at all.
Okay. Dave?
Yeah.
Makes it somewhat more difficult. People like to ask me about medical marijuana all the time, and I have to give a long spiel about it.
Okay, S Club 7 or Spice Girls, Jack?
My rating, like the quality of the music?
Nope.
Just favorite.
Yep.
I'd probably go Spice Girls anyway. I have some favorite S Club tracks.
Great. I mean, this was a question that I was never quite sure about. Author High School. Jack was really, really into both of them, and I never could tell. Mm. Which Spice Girl would you date?
Is my favorite. Would I date?
Which one would you most like to date?
I don't know. Maybe Posh Spice, just because you know that you're going to like go out on the town, have a good time, I guess.
Which of the Spice Girls would you most like to start a family with, Jack?
I don't know. Despite the name, I think Crazy might be the most down to earth. So I'd probably start a family with Crazy Spice.
Great. Which of the Spice Girls would you most like to serenade you?
Definitely down? Sporty Spice.
Sporty?
Sporty Spice all the way. Yeah, I love her voice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Angel. Angelic.
Any other Spice Girls related questions? I don't think we've really exhausted the well yet.
Let's get one that I can answer Baby to and one that I can answer Ginger to.
Youngest
who's
Spice
your favorite
Girl.
Redhead?
Yeah, who's your Spice. Favorite redhead Spice Girl?
Guys, I think this is our final quick hit question and probably the most important one. What kind of haircut would you most like to see on the President of the United States?
Very good one. I think I'd go with the haircut. I don't know the name of it. Some of these haircuts have names, but I'd go with the one from that music video, Firewalker by The Prodigy. That guy's yeah. got a really sweet haircut.
And no, I think it's a no-hawk.
Go wrong with that, yeah. Is it wow. the no-hawk?
I guess it's a no-hawk, and John Adams actually had that haircut. So.
Oh, cool. Okay, yeah. I'll just call it John Adams. And he was president already. I'm just yeah. living in the wrong time.
Yeah, you're a couple centuries too late.
I know who I'm writing in.
Who?
The corpse of John Adams. That's my write-in vote.
Did you guys have favorite haircuts? Or, I mean, haircuts that you would like to have the presidency? Or
That's
have?
A good question. Dave's probably got all over this.
I'd really like to see him get the same exact haircut as Kim Jong-un. It's just a powerful haircut.
You know what I think would be really cool? The hair on top of the head was cut and styled to look like facial hair so that it looked like a beard that was growing and like they had tattooed a mouth or something on top of their head. So it was like a beard or a mustache or a goatee. And every couple of months, the president would have changed up their facial hair, but it was actually the hair on top of their head that they made look like facial hair. I don't know why soccer players don't do that. That'd be amazing. You could do like a double beard, a beard on your chin and then a beard on top of your head.
I think there's one of those on World Cup hair.
Okay. Speaking of which, if jackbangeter.net wasn't enough for you, Jack's also the proprietor of a couple great tumblers. One is worldcuphair.tumblr.com, and the other one was like politicians eating bananas. What was that one called?
World leaders eating bananas.tumblr.com.
Okay.
And that's a project with another friend working on making politicians eat bananas together.
Talk about social change. I don't know why we didn't bring that up earlier in the episode. Art makes nothing happen. Yeah, right.
And bananas bring
a banana before.
Tell that to Angela Merkel. Well, that's all I got.
That's beautiful, guys. Bananas bring everybody together. And it's time to move on towards the end of our podcast. But we've got a couple exciting things still to talk about. Unchained Melodies. This week, we're going to share music to make art to.
I picked Barry White's Love Serenade. And this is something that my dad and I would listen to. And also some friends came along and would they remember Barry White as some art-making music. And this is one of my favorites. So get in the mood.
Take it on. I want you to wave and came into the don't want to feel no pain. I don't want to see no panties.
No, Barry.
And take home that museum, my dear. Everybody's gone. You take a receipt for all the food.
I'm going to whip my brush out right now.
Is that what you call it?
This night, we're gonna get it on. It's a love serenade.
Yeah, I can get down.
Wow.
Dave, that is exhibit 1A in the difference between amateurs and real artists. Just consider the song that Jack just played and the schlock that we're about to play. Go ahead, Dave. What do you got?
I can't even follow it up. Can we just end the show now?
Yeah, sure.
It's so good. Yeah, if I'm doing artistic type stuff, I like, I don't know what I like, but I like this song, the National, Afraid of Everyone.
Yeah, I could make some art to that too.
The stuff I'm seeing behind you looks a little bit dark. I think it would work. I think it would work with some of the stuff you're doing.
I get a little dark. I can go down that road.
Yeah. To that song, you'd have to be wearing your clothes while painting. Well, with Barry, I would expect you to be in the nude.
Yeah. Either way.
I get my brush out for anything. All right. So I'm going to play a song, or it's kind of a song. There's an avant-garde composer from New York named William Basinski, and he's kind of ambient drone music. It's minimalist, and he has these series of records. It's based on music that he recorded in the early 80s, and then he played these tapes in a loop that would slowly deteriorate over time and fall apart. And so there's like the music disintegrating as it's being looped, and they're called the Disintegration Loops. And this is a very long piece from the first of the Disintegration Loop records. It's called DLP 1.1. I'm going to jump ahead and just give you a flavor of what it sounds like 40 minutes later. If I'm thinking about getting in a space where I'm focused, concentrated on poetry, that series for me has been helpful, where I've got headphones on and I've got this repeated kind of ambient drone that's deteriorating. It's like the right mental space to make sad poems.
I think that's really interesting about that type of music, is that would be music that might actually influence my painting, where I think a lot of the other music that I listen to, if I listen to music while I'm making artwork, I kind of tend to just like shut it out, actually. Yeah. It's like something that's happening outside of my artwork. But that seems like more introspective, or you're able to get into the music and what you're doing.
And the reason why it doesn't influence me as a linguistic artist is that the thing that's too hard for me to listen to when I'm writing poems is something that has a strong, repeated rhythmic pattern. And so if there's a rhythm or a powerful beat, then it's difficult to think... To think syllabically and to think about my prosody or my without the metronome of the beat happening. And so I like having something that doesn't have like a regular repeated beat in the same way if I'm thinking about writing a poem that's...
Interesting fact, John Grisham listened to that while he wrote The Runaway Jury. It's a great work of art. Yeah.
Yeah, we all know Grisham. And
you're in the company of greats, Steele.
He loves the avant-garde composers, that John Grisham.
Yeah. Can't get enough.
So I've selected another track. It didn't really matter at this point what Beach Boys song it was, but Beach Boys is what one of my art friends, Knut, and I listened to Knut Benjaminsson, and I listened to in order to create a series of drawings. So we would listen to one Beach Boys song, and in the time that the Beach Boys song took to play, we would do our drawing. So... here's a Beach Boys song, and if you've got a pen and paper out, try doing a little sketch of something crazy while it's going. You can only imagine what kind of art we were creating, I guess.
Surfboards, coupes, yeah.
Something like that.
Castrati.
So I've got another
Barry
one
and
too,
the Beach
guys.
Boys. What else do you need?
What you need is more strange, slow-moving indie rock, because that's the only thing you should make art to. So that I've got another track of that for a mutual benefit. It's called Advanced Falconry.
She talks softly.
I'm going to add that into my Pandora mix. Yeah.
Well done, Dave.
Yeah.
Yes. That's the most I've ever influenced someone.
All right.
Just in my life. That's it.
You're now,
I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's ever going to play that, but kind of similar to some of the things that I play on my Pandora. So I think I'll try to get that in there too. That's good.
Dave, you need to put thought leader on your business cards now. You're now an official thought leader.
All right. Yeah.
So before I share this next track, I want to say that for me, another thing that I really feel committed to in art and the art that I appreciate, I like documentary art. Art that documents the real. And I also feel really committed to art that focuses our attention on the common, the ordinary, and the unremarkable in some ways. And this is a song that's moving to me. It's by Rostam, who was a member of Vampire Weekend, singer and guitarist. And it's essentially a song. He's a gay man, and it's a song about seeing the man that he loves, like in the morning, and just seeing this person and the sunlight on their face kind of thing. And I think it's got beautiful instrumentation, and it's moving to me as a thinking about that art that I'd like to make.
Very nice. Everything's so nice.
I think everybody did a great job. I think we really gave John Grisham some things to listen to, too. This guy, it's going to affect some of the things he's doing.
Yeah. You're welcome, John.
I know he's a big listener, big supporter of the program. We appreciate everything John says about us and what he does for us. So thank you. Yeah, he's a great writer, great American hero.
I don't know if you knew this, Jack, but Dave named his twins, both of them. He named both Grish.
Yeah.
Girl and a boy. Female Grish and male Grish.
Good. Perfect.
Yeah.
How do you call them differently? They're just expected to come and do the same thing at the same time?
Yeah. When you have this many children, it's all scheduled. There's no need to differentiate. Just like there's a little need to differentiate between John Grisham's novels as well. Like they, you know, it's just like one collected work that just keeps going. It's beautiful.
Slightly different colored cover each time. That's the only difference.
Which leads us, of course, into a segment where John Grisham has been featured on almost every single episode, but he's not today, but that's okay. Book wisdom. And I think Jack's going to share something for us.
I do have a little book wisdom. This is written actually in a letter by Paul Gauguin, who's a famous painter. You might know him. And he's writing to a an artist, Emil Schuffenecker, and he's kind of like an up-and-coming artist of the time, just trying to learn to make his way. And I think these words apply to much more than just an approach to art, but an approach to any of life's problems, is how I kind of look at it. Work freely and madly. You will make progress, and sooner or later, people will learn to recognize your worth, if you have any. Above all, don't sweat over a painting. A great sentiment can be rendered immediately. Dream on it and look for the simplest form in which you can express it.
Wow. Awesome. I really like that. That's way better than the depressing shit that I usually read.
Does that mean a light note to the end of this relatively depressing episode?
Anyone have any closing thoughts on death they want to add? Hey, so Gauguin, what happened to him? Did he die?
Yeah, he did die. He was in on an island in Tahiti, and I can't remember exactly what he died from. A crazy disease, I think, his like face got all puffy, and what is that? One of those old diseases that doesn't really happen anymore, I think.
I think it's called the Martin Short pure luck syndrome.
Yeah, maybe.
Anaphylaxis.
Oh, Dave's the yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, he was pretty hardcore painter on that island for a while.
Nice.
Married some young native chick.
Yep. Everybody should do that at some point. But no, I like the positive thought. I just kind of go for it. I think everybody's got some worth in them somewhere. Everybody probably has some artistic sentiment that they can share. And with the playlist that we've given them now, everybody should be ready to do it. So thanks for being here, Jack. I think our pilot episode of Art Talk with Jack Bangeter, A+. We nailed it.
That's a wrap.
All right. Well, thanks for having me, guys. Pleasure.
Off the chain. It's off the chain.
For this podcast, I'll be Dick Pound.
Okay.
Dave sent me an email about this because this is a real guy. He used to be in charge of like the anti-doping agency.
There's also that old baseball player, Rusty Kuntz.
I sent Dave an email about that. I told you me and Jack were friends.
Yeah, that was Steele's reply.